My name is Andreas Ferber. I'm a product manager from SUSE Labs for the ARM architecture. And right now I'm going to talk about what's new with the Tumbleweed ARM ports. As usual, short disclaimer, this is about software, so this is not a guide about what hardware you should be buying or should not be buying. If you have specific questions for projects, do ask us beyond this particular talk. Then we can give you biased advice on what you think about that. And obviously, some of those things mentioned here have been supported by hardware donations or help with particular boards from people or vendors. As a brief outline, I'm going to remind of the different dimensions of support for the ARM architecture that we have been working on. Every year I have a very different focus point. This will be this time firmware and the Spectre and Meltdown security vulnerabilities that I will be going into with some more time. This year we do not have a hardware showcase here, and I will not have as many hardware updates, but still a number. So, when we're talking about ARM and supporting ARM, we've already talked about microcontrollers. Let's leave that aside for this talk. So in particular, there's a number of chips that exist, and there's new chips coming out over time. There's been new chips coming out since last OpenSUSE conference. With those chips, vendors are building a number of boards. So usually there's a one-to-N relation between them, one chip, several different boards in several configurations. And then there's a third configuration that is becoming increasingly important as we are actually getting to a point where things are running stable and mature on the various boards, is then you're not only happy if you're able to boot to a prompt on the system, but you actually want to, you know, like control a robot with it, or, you know, do other fun things with it in, you know, the maker sense. Now, let me start by getting into the topic of recent security vulnerabilities first. In order to understand what this is about, I'm going to talk about how the boot workflow works, at least in theory, on AR64 boards. And then I'm going to go into a bit more details. So, AP in this case stands for Application Processor. So I'm assuming that to some point, we're getting to the point where there is power on that particular CPU. Sometimes there's like service processors or management cores that take over that function, in particular in server class CPUs. But when we're talking about like single board computers, then in most cases, we will have a rather direct boot flow. And either the boot ROM, well, the boot ROM definitely does, but possibly also an initial software component provided by the vendor or yourself would start doing initializations. And what you can see on the right of this slide over here is that there are different exception levels listed. So going down from EL3 down to EL0. And this roughly corresponds to what you would refer to as rings on the Intel architecture, and maybe on the top you would have like SMM. In any case, I'm just going to talk about 64-bit ARM here. It's slightly different for AH32. And the next step would be, so the rough idea is that the chip comes up with only minimal peripherals working, and you don't have any external RAM available yet. You have the internal SRAM, the static RAM, and that is, well, a few kilobyte, if you're lucky, maybe megabyte or something, that is available for initial code execution. And what you at that point need to do is to actually initialize the RAM that you can then run further components into. So these are small individual components that chain load each other until you have like the actual workload that is working. Now this is in this case, as far as the ARM Trusted Firmware, that's this TFA, is concerned, the default defined case is that this actually runs in EL1 and relies on services provided by the BL1 component in order to have certain hypercalls, usually that's done via SMC calls, to provide a certain entry point that you want the higher level exception level to jump to code, because once you've dropped privileges, as with as you might know from your user space processes, you can't just gain like root privileges again so easily. However, if you don't have a ROM or component that implements those functionalities in EL3, you have no chance of getting back. So there's also an alternative way to do the BL2, and that is to host BL2 at the exception level 3, where it then has the sufficient privileges to run pretty much all code that it wants. This is what typically the U-boot secondary program loader, or in some cases there's also a tertiary program loader, so a third one, where you have like 1, 2, 3 executing one after another due to space constraints for the respective code blobs. Or you can also use, again, ARM trusted firmware for this part of the initialization. The next step then is called BL3.1. And this is where most of the runtime services are getting hosted. So they have the highest exception level, so they have access to really everything in the secure domain. That is, by the way, the green line with the distinction SNS. So on the left side, everything that we are looking at up to now is in the secure domain, so this has access to special parts of RAM that may not be accessible from a non-secure world. And this component is being used for power control, among others, in particular the PSEI interface is what we're using from Linux. Heiko, do you have any additions that I'm missing out on here? Matthias? Okay. I mean, I know there are some other abbreviations that are also hidden in this one, but I guess they're not so relevant and not so well known. So, at that point in the process, there is an option to load a secure operating system. And secure operating system, in this case, is not OpenSUSE, but is usually a trusted execution environment, which is related to doing secure crypto operations, storing keys, signing things in a way that is isolated from the actual operating system. And this can then run at the kind of equivalent to user space applications under Linux, run some small apps that perform certain functions according to their API. Apart from Opti being the one that is being developed by Linaro for ARM, there's also one from NVIDIA called TLK, as well as several third-party commercial ones that are probably not so relevant for boards running OpenSUSE. Afterwards, usually at EL2, we will have the actual bootloader, which then implements the UEFI interfaces, be loaded as BL3.3. And from there on, we would then be able to load, if we want grub, if it's actually working, that's what I'll be mentioning later on, and from either U-boot, EDK2, or grub, we could then load Linux, and I've been told that by now it is mostly running in EL2. There's also the option of having it run in EL1, but in particular, if you want to use hypervisor services like KVM, then it needs to run in EL2. And obviously, the regular user space applications then running at the least exception level. Any questions so far? I know it's a lot of numbers, but these are actually numbers that on boards that do implement this, you will get a lot of debug output when it starts saying, and it will print out all those BL something numbers, and you know that it's jumping from one point to another. And I'll be getting to why that becomes relevant shortly. Okay. So, hitting you with a full scope of this. So in January this year, there was a disclosure that pretty much everyone should have heard of by now, because it does not only affect ARM, it mainly originally was about Intel, that there are certain features in the processor designed to run code fast that unfortunately led to some security vulnerabilities used by clever hackers in order to use timing effects to read data that you shouldn't actually be able to read. Now, there are multiple variants in which this can be exploited. So the variant one listed here is a bounce check bypass. So if you have like an, if A is less than equals than 200, do something, it would simply do it irrespective of whether or not that condition is true. Speculatively try to do this access, and if at the right point in time you would read certain registers, then you would have an intermediate value be available to code. A second variant of that would be a branch target injection. So when you're actually jumping to code to get access to what you should not be having access to, as well as the more the most impactful one, with which is codenamed Meltdown, is when user space processes would be able to access data in the address space that they should not usually have access to, as well as an ARM-specific variant that was then about certain coprocessor registers, part of the chip. And what is now new since last week, May 21st, is a new variant 4, where stores are able to bypass loads. The description is slightly longer than that. I won't go into the exact details of which bits are being ignored in the implementation from the various vendors. Fact is that those security vulnerabilities exist. If you're running a board with a slow, low-cost core, chances are that you're not affected, in particular the Cortex-A53, which is very present, like in all the all-winner boards, is not affected by this one. So the Raspberry Pi is not affected either. But if you're running any core, any better cores, like Cortex-A57 on the soft iron Overdrive X1000, or more recent versions of the high keyboard, the Macchiato bin, and of course a various server from other vendors as well, are affected by this. And for some of those cases, it is necessary to not just update your Linux system, but also firmware. And in one case, even the secure OS if you're using one. So that means, in addition to updating your kernel with the mitigations of trying to avoid those circumstances within the kernel, it is also necessary to take manual action if you own such a board and actually deploy a new version of the firmware on that board. For the Raspberry Pi is pretty much the only board that we have an automatic mechanism where by doing a zip-a-dupe, you can actually get a new firmware package that will then be used on board. But for any other ones, you would need to DD the component by hand. And well, if you're in the lucky position to own an actual server board, then you can get firmware updates from the respective vendor, and you have a nice user interface that you can just flash them like you could, you know, update the firmware on an Intel-based computer. But if you actually have those small, cheap single board computers, then you will need to take care of that yourself. And for that purpose, we've started to collect the various firmware-related packages into a new develop project called hardware:boot in OBS, where also some packages that are not part of factory are being made available. In particular, the ARM Trusted Firmware is there. I've also prepared some Opti builds there, as well as EDK2 packages for a few boards. Any questions about that so far? Okay. Then I'm moving on to the actual boards. What is new there in that domain? I'm starting with the V6 version. The Raspberry Pi 0W was mentioned last year. It is using the same chipset as the original Raspberry Pi, ARM 11. There is a U-boot RPi 0W build separately available. That is the one that I have been using. That's why there are still some question marks in there. So we have made a recent change to the way that we boot all the variants of the Raspberry Pi. So previously, there's the binary and proprietary Raspberry Pi firmware that executes on the graphic core of the Raspberry Pi. And from there on, we load our U-boot. And so far, U-boot was configured to ship its own device tree. So that meant that if you read a tutorial somewhere on the internet that said, you know, take the config txt file, add some magic line that would, you know, make some hardware work that you wanted to use, that would actually not work because U-boot would override whatever was configured by the firmware. And as such, you would have to, it was possible to use them, but it needed to be like redone on the level one, higher or lower, depending on how you look. As I mentioned, I've been testing this with the RPi 0W, but in theory, it should work with the U-boot-RPi because Alex Graf has worked on passing the DT from the firmware into the U-boot bootloader so that whatever has been correctly configured by the Raspberry Pi firmware would then be available to our bootloader as well. And I have been testing just before this conference again that it is actually booting now with the Tumbleweed kernel. There were originally some difficulties because certain UART drivers were missing in the ARM v6 kernel because so far they had not been used, and also there were some changes necessary for the Wi-Fi chip, which on the 0W is very similar to what the Raspberry Pi 3 does. So it may be possible that you need to touch the config txt file in order to add some lines there. By the way, touching the config.txt file is how I describe making the change, but it's not the most clever way. So we actually have an include mechanism there, which is called something with extra in the name, extra config or so, that is then actually included from the config.txt file so that the config.txt file can still be updated by our packages without breaking anything. Moving on to ARM v7. So at the last OpenSUSE conference, we had the Turris Omnia router presented there using a Marvell Armada 32-bit chip. By now, we have an upstream-based package for the U-boot Turris Omnia. Unfortunately, last time that I was testing it, it was not quite working. So I'll need to retest that, but at least with the downstream version with a few modifications, I have been able to boot a regular OpenSUSE kernel by now, not just some self-compiled version. So this is working well by now. Also, using the switch ports, so this is not just a board, but actually an enclosed an enclosed router board. It is possible to configure it not via YAST, there's still a bug, but at least via the kernel interfaces and manual text config files, so that you can actually use it for connecting several boards to that, or having your own routing, bridging, and whatever setup you may want to configure. I had spoken about the guitar board last year. A board using the same chip, the Action Semi S500, is the Sparky board. The vendor has kindly helped test that. Same as all the other Action boards, there is no mainline U-boot for that yet, so it is not yet possible to boot OpenSUSE on there, and I have been working on getting patches into mainline as time permits, but so far only booting to serial console and an init RD is working. And on this particular board, I'm still seeing problems with the serial console. So I can actually read what the board is doing. It's executing just fine, but I'm not able to actually provide input to the shell on the init RD. So going to the 64-bit world and focusing on that obviously a bit more. So what is new for the Pine64 board is that finally we can use the kernel default. So previously we had a contrib kernel, which was carrying a few patches on top. Now Ethernet is working fine as well in the default kernel from Tumbleweed. And also the U-boot package is now self-sufficient in that it includes a secondary program loader now, so it does not need any binary blob before that anymore. The only limitation at this point is that it relies on the ARM trusted firmware, and we don't have ARM trusted firmware in factory, so that's why this package still needs to be taken from the contrib Pine64 package, even though the source code for this is in factory. And I recently switched the Juice package over to use this new kernel, so that is in the contrib Pine64 project. The Mikado bin, another board that frequently gets asked about. Unfortunately, Marvell does not have the code for their chips in the mainline upstream ARM trusted firmware project, so they're like two versions behind still at this point. It was not immediately possible for me to do the backports for the TF side fixes for Spectre based on that version. They've been doing that on their own sometime later then. At the moment, I'm still waiting for the V4 fixes to be come out, but either way, unfortunately, the packages, the way that I have them prepared in OBS, are unfortunately not yet booting. Not sure why that is. Any help with debugging that will be appreciated. But U-boot is available for some time, and if you simply use the U-boot that ships on the board from Marvell on there, you can actually load, for example, from network or from SD card, a newer U-boot, and use the features that are available in there with some restrictions. And that is actually working so far. So I've managed to boot into the installer. At least the basics are working. It might be that some additional drivers are not available or something. Has anyone recently been playing with that one? Okay, Peter's not here, yeah. Then one of the first cheap 64-bit ARM boards was the HiKey out of the 96 boards project from Linaro, with a HiSilicon chip on that. I had it working with ATF14 and was testing the Spectre mitigations on there, even though not strictly needed for the Cortex-A53 it has. Unfortunately, with version 1.5, it stopped working for me, so there were some changes. If you remember the explanation about the various bootloader components, they switched from the EL1-based BL2 to a EL3-based BL2, and somehow in that process things broke for us. Although on another board, I'll be mentioning that is not generally the case, so that remains to be debugged. There's a bug reported to Blenar about that. Yeah. So just don't be confused. There is a Drew's Heike image around in a contract project, but that is highly outdated, so it uses some custom kernel from the original days of when this was being worked on by Linaro. So in theory, the Juice EFI package should be working as far as the device tree in the U-boot package that we ship is up to date. It may be that a DTP package or file needs to be added to the image in order to make it boot. The installer was not yet booting, so they have a mailbox driver that is needed for certain power operations during startup. And without that driver, it was not able to actually reach the installer. So I'll need to adapt the installation images to include those drivers. The Heike 960 is the successor, which actually has cores that are, as mentioned before, affected by the Spectre vulnerability. A similar problem here, although slightly different. It also changed to the BL2 at EL3 and is no longer working at the moment. And also previously, I did not have kernels booting from SD card on this board using the regular kernel. So using some Linaro kernel, it was working, but not using ours. Poplar is another one with a high silicon chip from the 96 boards family. Surprisingly, after the V15 BL2 at EL3 update, it is still working both for recovery and for normal boot modes. U-boot is packaged for this, and it has started to boot, but I have not been able to entirely retest it before this talk still. Then a new board with a very quick mention, the Dragon Board 410C has been around for some time. There was recent a refresh with the Snapdragon 820 chip. This is using, same as the board that Matthias mentioned yesterday, the little kernel as a bootloader. So in that case, what can be done is to simply chain load from LK U-boot, if a U-boot is available, which I understand for MediaTek it's not yet, because someone would actually need to re-implement all the drivers for, well, accessing SD, EMMC, and so on. This is packaged for the new Dragon board, but not yet tested whether the chain loading from LK works, and in particular whether UEFI support in Grub works. So that was previously the problem with the Dragon Board 410C. For one, there were some redistributability issues with some of the binary firmware blobs that execute before we get to those open source bootloaders. And also, it was possible to boot a kernel via U-boot, but not booting Grub from U-boot. Then an update from the NVIDIA world. The Tegra X1-based Jetson board that's using, you know, an NVIDIA-manufactured module, not just a chip on a development board that could, in theory, run on multiple carrier boards. For that, the 1.5 version of Trusted Firmware A is actually working just fine. And it is affected by the vulnerabilities. So that is good news. I just need to apply the patches still for that. U-boot is available. UEFI unfortunately was not yet working, and I needed to revert to the version R24 of the NVIDIA-provided Linux Fortegra framework. So that's basically, in this case, the bootloader blobs that execute before we get to these parts of ATF. But with that, kernel 4.16 and 4.17 are finally working fine on this board. Something that I cannot say about the X2 version yet. So I've been having trouble even flashing any firmware at all to the X2 version of the board. So with the X1, no problem. With the X2, it did not work with Leap 15. And unhelpfully, if you search for such problems, there's lots of forum posts that all say, oh yeah, just take Ubuntu 14.4 and it will magically work. No one really works why it works with an really ancient distribution instead of recent one, like, of course, our Leap and Tumbleweed distributions. When using the version that NVIDIA ships themselves, obviously, UEFI was not working yet, and the kernel was starting to boot, but not actually finding the boot device, so not really much to do. But as mentioned for another board before, the plan here is that if we have a UEFI-compatible bootloader flashed onto the board, so not on the boot medium, then we can just take the existing Juice EFI image and do not need an image that is specific to the board or the chip that it is going to run on. And that is, in general, a course of action to generalize the images more. I will say a bit more about that in a few moments. That we need to consolidate the very rapid growth of images in OBS. So Alex has been working on a very new Xilinx-based 96 board called the Ultra 96. This is packaged in a contrib repository for now due to some tools dependencies there. U-boot is actually packaged in the main line. I just didn't verify the exact name. But it is there. It's using the standard kernel, and it is working so far as Alex has tested it, which is very new that this board is out for a few months at most, and it's already in a state that something can execute on it. For one, that's because the chip has been around for a time and Xilinx has been working with SUSE on enabling it also for SLES products, but also there was a very good collaboration with the vendor of the board in order to let OpenSUSE run as probably the first real distribution on this board. If we're thinking of the chips axis again, one new chip that has come out is the Allwinner H6. Unfortunately, last time I checked on this, U-boot was still in very early changes with an early patch set, and people were still using the FEL boot mode to try loading something via USB on there, since the DRAM initialization code was not yet there. Does anyone happen to have an update on this in the audience? So if you're thinking about it, just don't confuse the Pine 64, which is working quite well, and the Pine H64, which is using a very new incompatible SOC that is not yet well enabled. And similarly, allow me to mention that there is the first Realtek-based single board computer now. The situation with that, I had talked about that at OpenSUSE Asia Summit and also briefly mentioned it last year at OpenSUSE Conference. There is a significant lack of source code for this platform, to put it mildly. And I've been trying to, in some cases, just by trial and error, to get parts of this mainline. I do have some patches in my in my GitHub repository, not in the mainline Linux repository, where By now, at least on the RTD 1295, it is possible to boot into OpenSUSE via SATA. So not yet via SD and so on, and using various blobs from the vendors to actually get there, but it is possible by now, and it's mainly just the DT patches for describing RTD 1296 and this particular board that are missing. Now then, some other mentions. Let me start with Michael has a talk about open source routers, and there is an ongoing crowdfunding project, the Taurus MOX, based on the Marvell Armada 3720 processor. We have seen OpenSUSE booting on that yesterday. Yay! Also using the same chip, Matvey has been working on running OpenSUSE on the Espresso bin. There are still some pieces missing in our repositories about that, in particular for deploying the firmware. This is very different, unfortunately. Well, just like all the chips are very different from each other, it's different from the boot flow on the Mercado bin. As such, it is not yet integrated into the OBS develop project, but it's on a very good way to get there. Similarly, with another ROC chip-based CPU, Matvey has been working on the ROC 64 board, that's the RK3328, and my colleague Yusuf has been working on the Firefly RK3399 and the corresponding ROC chip Sapphire evaluation board for the RK3399. Upstreaming projects, actually that is a typo, that should not be Rockchip, so sorry Heiko, that should be Realtek is the one that I've been working on getting patches into, Action Semi as well, that would be the Bubblegum 96 as well as the Guitar and the Sparky that I mentioned today and a few others. And shortly after the last OpenSUSE conference, we received an FQ board from Fujitsu. This is using a SUSENEXT processor from the Fujitsu heritage. I have started writing the patches, but they have not yet gone upstream. Then some very brief updates that I already touched on. So at OpenSUSE Asia Summit, I had given a more broader overview and insight into where we are with set-top boxes, in particular what difficulties are involved there. And here's a few models that by now have been tested to at least boot to some degree. Unfortunately, I found that it varies a lot between, even if they have the same chip and the same crappy vendor boot blobs in there. It will vary quite a lot how they're actually configured. So on some devices, you will have a convenient way to actually load new bootloaders, new kernels via the network, or possibly even from SD card. On others, that will be completely broken, and the only way to get something new on there will be a serial transfer, which unfortunately I have not yet found a suitable way to automate. Some new chips that I have been looking into but not yet made real progress, so just to give some inspiration maybe, is the S905W, so S905, S912 and so on from MLogic already in the kernel, but this one is new and not yet tested. There's been some hardware difficulties on getting serial access, and the T926E I have started working on, but not yet having a proof of concept kernel to present. Similarly, using the same similar chips as mentioned before, so I have an upstream-based kernel booting on the RTD 1296-based storage box, which is the same chip as mentioned in the new Banana Pi W2 board. Unfortunately, there is not a lot of time left to talk about expansion boards. Just very briefly, let me say that for the Raspberry Pi, as mentioned, there's this config.txt mechanism. For other boards, there would be the possibility to not just override the device tree with a one that has been extended by yourselves, but in recent versions, we have enabled overlay support so that you can load a DTBO file to be added on top of the actual DTB file. And then once the kernel knows that this hardware is present in your system, you know, connected to those 40-pin connector rows or whatever your board has in particular, there's two ways to actually work with them. One is there's drivers like I2C Dev and SpyDev that make a device available that you can then use from a user space program to directly access the pins and write and read from there. However, from a kernel perspective, that is not always desirable, in particular when various projects that are available somewhere in GitHub will then start to actually probe hardware from user space, although actually you have the hardware description already elsewhere. As such, there is what is new since last year, there is a ZerDev framework where you can actually chain a kernel driver to the serial port, which is useful for things like Bluetooth, for example, and you don't have to run any weird HCI attach commands from user space anymore, or I've been using that for some wireless drivers that were using some AT protocol via serial, and certainly several more use cases. And then there's a whole range of industrial I/O drivers in the Linux kernel for sensors, converters of various kinds. So if there's anything that you need, we can easily enable the options in the Tumbleweed kernel. You can either then use those I/O drivers from other kernel drivers directly, or use certain frameworks and tools in order to access them from user space. Yeah. These are some of the project that I'm still working on. So like sensors, if a sensor is not yet in the I/O framework implemented, then it's relatively easy to do that yourself. What I'm also working on is LoRa drivers. So I figured that it is not really useful to keep re-implementing this in various user space projects. So instead, I would prefer to have a socket-based interface to simply use it the same way that you would like 802.15.4 devices, or you know, Ethernet devices, Wi-Fi. And another area that I've been looking into is industrial Ethernet, so where you have RJ45 connectors that are using the Ethernet protocol, but not the usual TCP/IP communication that you would run on them, but rather some customized protocols with real-time capabilities. TSN is the new thing, the time-sensitive networks, which is supported by the kernel if you have suitable compatible hardware. But there's various other protocols such as EtherCAT that various expansion boards exist for that are then accessed mostly via SPI protocol. With that, I've rushed to the end. Do we have any quick questions?
Is the config.txt changes for the Raspberry Pi documented on the wiki yet?
I don't quite think so.
Okay, I'll have fun with that later.
What change in particular are you asking about?
Just in order to enable certain drivers on the GPIO, or like SPI, I2C.
So no, but in theory, the documentation that is available on raspberrypi.org should be 99% applicable to what we have. So like, you know, we still need to configure the config text to load our U-boot, which is slightly different from what Raspbian does, or at least did in the past. But we ship the same DTBO files that are coming from the Raspberry Pi firmware repository. So those can just be used out of the box, and there's no restrictions on that that I'm currently aware of.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Further questions? Okay, then, thank you very much for your attention.